Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Bog here every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern right here on Dave Martell channel, which you should like, subscribe, share. Right now, click the little alert button so you can alert every time we go live, like I said, which is every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern with me and my boy Tristan and all kinds of awesome stuff that we bring to you, talking about folkishness, talking about spirituality, talking about, you know, anything that comes out of our minds is really great stuff. So make sure you like, subscribe, share, and make sure to click the alert button. Everybody's been talking about YouTube messing with us, they're messing with everybody, really. Everybody's saying they're not getting alerts from anywhere. I have some of my favorite channels that go live. I don't get the alert, so make sure you click the alert button if you want to get alert every time The Bog goes live every single Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern. We have a lot to talk about tonight before we get started. Like always, I want to give a shout out to my homegirl, Miss Hannah, at traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Stop giving your money to the multinational globalist vampires that hate your guts and sell you poison, synthetics, plastics that trashes your hair, trashes your body, trashes your skin. Give your money to somebody that loves you. Opt out of the system that destroys you. And, man, get some of this stuff, man. It comes right from the earth. Get some beard oil. Get some lotion. Get some hair conditioner. Man, it's great stuff. It's great stuff. I promise you're going to love it. Get some for you, for your wife or your girlfriend or your mom or something. Or just get it for yourself. Have a ladies' night and get something for yourself. Go to traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Promo code Dave to get 10% off. You're going to love it. I guarantee it. Now, we got a lot to talk about tonight, so we're just going to get right into it. My boy Tristan's back. We took off last week because it's Thanksgiving and all that, but we are right back with The Bog. And tonight we have our good friend, our good buddy and colleague from the Neurona Society, Mr. Mark Pereer, here to talk about quite a few things. The title is Rites and Rituals, but we got quite a few really, really fascinating topics that we're going to get into tonight. But before we get to, let's just get right into it. Tristan, Mark, how are we doing tonight, guys?
Well, I'm doing pretty all right. Dave, how are you doing, Mark?
I'm doing great, man. Great to be here. Great to see you guys again on the show.
Absolutely. Look at this. Three Neurona guys on the same stream, tearing it up, moving up in the world. We're really growing, man. But speaking of Neurona Society, what we're going to talk about tonight is a lot of Neurona research that's coming out. It's really, really great stuff. You know, every single day I'm in the forums reading, you know, being a part of it, and it just blows my mind with the amount of really in-depth research that's never been done before that is coming out of this organization. And tonight, Mr. Mark is going to talk to us about a few things. So let's get started, Mr. Mark. Tell us about the 9-square grid. What is it, and what is the significance of it?
Well, the thing was is that, you know, we were looking at, we kind of set up, Tristan and I actually set up a little Telegram chat, and we were talking about, you know, basically how to establish a sacred space, like what is required in that, what kind of symbols are used, what, how did it work, how did they use them? And we started looking up saga references, histories, Vedic references, things like this, right? And we started noticing the recurrence of this square grid that they used in a lot of the sources. There's mentions of it in some of the sagas, Saxo mentions it. And then Tristan actually was the one who pointed out that there is a Vedic tradition where they used it's sort of a 9-square grid with like a bunch of squares around it. And each square represents a different like deity or a connection to a deity or something like that. And so we really wanted to understand like what they were doing. And we all know that 9 is the holy number. Like it's the sacred number. Yep. It's the number of gestation, and it's the, you know, there's 9 Valkyries and nine homes and all these different things connecting to that. And we really believed that, you know, if we're going to look at something, if we're going to build or establish a tradition or an idea or a ritual concept, we really want to try to see how it can come from the sources. Like, how can we build it from source material? How can we be inspired by that source material in order to create something that's significant for all of us, right? So the thing that we did, that we were already working on something else that we'll also talk about tonight, but we were looking at, you know, the significance of the underworld and how that sort of connects and relates to, you know, sort of the idea of 9 and the 9, you know, the 9 features of the underworld, basically. Because when we're seeing this, when we're looking at the ideas behind the symbolism of each, you know, ritual component and each ritual item and the what's said in the histories about how they would stand in a sacred grove, and they would have, you know, Adam of Bremen mentions that there were wells in the grove, and you have things like when Baldur's horse steps on the ground, it creates a sacred spring or sacred well, you know. And so there's a lot of different histories and a lot of different sources that mention the sanctity of an area, of a space, of a certain way to connect to the land, of connecting to the cosmology. And we wanted to reflect that. So we started looking at, like, how can we do this? How can we establish this? And how can we use this 9-square grid, which we see in the sources? You know, one of the sagas talks about them setting up lattice work with 9 squares around it, possibly building 4 gates around them and establishing those gates as an enclosure, a sacred V, you know, and allowing them to have a somewhere that is specified as holy for them, right? And when we're looking at that and we're trying to understand, like, how did they make something? How did they separate it from the mundane? How did they make it actually sacred? You know, then we look at them. How did they carve out certain areas? How did they, you know, sanctify them? What gods did they pray to and stuff like that? So that's really what we were looking at when we were building the 9-square grid, basis.
And that's a real important topic to discuss here, is that our ancestors did sanctify certain places specifically to delineate it from the profane, mundane reality around them. That when they were performing rituals, this defined area was considered of ritual importance to be sacred, yep, and everything else was considered outside of the ritual format.
Yeah,
right.
Which a square handily covers. I mean, everyone knows that whatever is inside the square is obviously sanctified.
Yeah, when I did my show with our friend Mr. Jamie Martin, he went in really deeply into talking about the idea of, you know, what on the Saxon side of things, what they call hallig, or what is holy and holy space and stuff like that. And, you know, if you get into reading about metaphysics of ritual and the metaphysics of ceremony and stuff like that, it's really big on creating sacred space and also sacred time, that when you're doing these rituals like bloats and stuff, you enter in a period of time that essentially transcends time. You are standing in a period of time, a broken off little holy place that your ancestors stood and that your kids will also stand. And this is it's a really special thing. And that's what, you know, in my opinion, that's why, or at least one of the reasons why, when we perform bloat, it feels so special and it resonates so deeply.
Right. And the thing about it is that, you know, and really sort of laying the groundwork of our conversation here, I want to explain, you know, what the purpose of ritual is, what the basis of bloat is for us, right? Now, there was a, and I understand, you know, I know, like, we talk a lot about Neolithic culture because it's spread all over Europe and it's not Indo-European, but it does have, you know, some certain ideas behind it. And there are some very interesting theories connected to things like Stonehenge and things like that that relate a lot to what we're talking about. Because really, as we're delving more and more into the concept of ritual and the concept of bloat, right, we're really getting into the minds of people who, you know, lived a sacred life and wanted to actually, you know, connect to the gods and believed in them wholeheartedly, right? So when you look at the lore and you understand the lore, and you know, like you and I have discussed, we've all discussed before about the Thing of the Dead, right? The Thing of the Dead was something that was more than likely very sacred to our ancestors. It was probably a very big deal to them. And that would have been the moment, like the very first moment as a human being, if you died, like that would be the moment that you would see the gods, right? For the first time, like physically, like you would actually come in contact with them. And this is why this is so important, because if I think that the ritual is an act of trying to reach that moment in the here and now, sort of a sympathetic magic or connecting to it in a ritualistic sense, because all of the symbols that we're finding, all of the things that we're looking at, it always goes back to the underworld and unequivocally so. There's like pretty much no like going around it, you know, like where else is it, you know, where else can you look? And the thing is that when you understand the cosmology and you understand the basis of it, right, and you start to see all of these different, you know, symbols of things like the drinking horn and the hammer and the bloat bowl and the oath ring and all of these different things that you would put an altar, like every single one of them goes back to the underworld and the Thing of the Dead and judgment and, you know, the idea of an afterlife and reaching the gods, yeah, right? So when we're seeing that, like that's the purpose of bloat. It's building these symbols on top of other symbols and sort of relating them to one another in order to reach that moment of convening with the gods, right? And so it becomes like the most sacred act. And so there's a National Geographic special that was done on Stonehenge that I thought was really fascinating, because what they did was they they built the idea or the theory that Stonehenge and a lot of the Neolithic cultures were doing the same thing, that they were basically building these structures in order to try to reach the realms of the dead. And the reason why they came up with this is because what a lot of people don't know is that in connection to these hinges that exist all over Northern Europe, there's also wood hinges. And they believe that the wood hinges actually represented life, you know, and because wood is the building material. It's the structure of the home. It's where you live. It's your community. It's connected to you. It's also the world tree. The human beings were made of Ask and Imbla were made out of wood. And the pole gods are made out of wood. And wood was a way to make things, implements, bowls, all kinds of different structures and ideas were connected to that.
The nine wood wives.
Right. And you had that as well. The sacred need fire, which sanctifies the space, is connected to that. That was how we actually discovered this whole connection to the underworld, because looking at Heimdall and looking at the need fire, you know, and you have the Völuspá where they talk about the nine Ívidjur, which means wood wives or wood women. It's talking about the nine woods of the need fire. And then Heimdall takes on a whole different aspect because you're talking about him as Vorthgoda, which means, the protecting god, the warding god, right? And he's the one who protects the underworld. That's where the Jotuns are. That's where the Rimthursas and Niflhel are. And he protects the base of the bridge, you know, from being attacked by them. And he literally goes around and protects that area just as he does the sacred space. And so the sacred space takes on a whole different meaning to us when we're looking at that, because we see that in, like, Adam of Bremen and a lot of the different histories, they have mentions of them, you know, using groves and using trees. And when you stand at the stalli and you're there, you know, praying to the gods, you're looking up to the tree, then you literally are standing at the roots. And the roots are the underworld. You know, that's the cosmology. The cosmology is a tree. And the tree, you know, when you're standing on the roots in the cosmological view, you're standing at the roots of the tree. Mm. And then you pray upwards and you see, like Adam of Bremen mentions, where they had, you know, sacrifices hanging in the trees. And that's because they're trying to send them to the gods. And so there's a lot of symbolism that comes at play here. But every single time we're looking at them trying to, you know, mimic that moment of meeting the gods in the realm of the dead.
Yeah, and you outlined a lot of this, speaking of the hell thing and stuff like, you mentioned a lot of this in your last book right here. I have it on screen, the Otis book right here. Right. This is a really great book, by the way. You guys, this is more than just a really great book. This is probably, if you are fresh into Also True, or if you're looking to expand your knowledge into more in-depth stuff, this is great for both. This is one of the most important reads. This must be on your bookshelf. Otis book. You can find that on Amazon. Odisbook.
Right.
And you know, Mark, I would like to bring us back here to what you were saying about the sacred time of ritual, because that compares very well to the anthropological theories of Mircea Eliade and his eternal return, the idea that and sacred time, the idea that most religious cultures structure their rituals as a sort of reenactment of famous events that perhaps great heroes or the gods themselves actually performed. So would you say that this also compares well with some of the stuff we have in our lore, that a lot of the structures we have seem to be set up almost like a play, something that you could reenact yourself. Would you say that as Heimdall wards the sacred space amongst the greater world in a metaphysical sense, that us calling a ritual space together and creating this sacred space is almost like a reenactment of Heimdall's metaphysical purpose?
Absolutely. And you can see that. You can see that evolution, you know, in sources like when you're looking at the Greeks, you know, the Greeks went from doing, you know, more abstract rituals to actually performing plays and recreating the lore in their ceremonies. Mm-hmm. And this would have been done in our faith as well. This would have been something that our ancestors would have absolutely, you know, recreated. I was actually just looking at the celebration of May Day and doing, you know, Kvasir Academy work. And in doing so, I was looking at Falsblot or Falstag. Now, Falstag is a reconstructed word from the German Fulstag or Pulitag, which, Grimm talks about. And he was basically saying that, you know, this is this is, you know, the same as the word Fáller in Old Norse. And in the Prosetta prologue, it actually talks about how, you know, Baldur was, in a euhemerous sense, that he was the leader of Westphalia. And Fáller is the same word. It's the same connection. Anyway, the idea of this is that in Tacitus Germania, he mentions the only entertainment that our ancestors had at that time was they would stand around in a circle and they would point spears at naked youths who would dance about, right? Now, William Reeves actually believes, and I kind of agree with him, that that this is basically a recreation of the Mannringer, which is a recreation of the death of Baldur. You know, the gods would stand around in a circle and they would throw spears and swords and weapons at Baldur in a game, you know, a leika. And the word leika, lake, L-E-I-K, was would also mean dancing or playing games, right? And this became, like, possibly the whole idea of dancing around a maypole may have come from this. Like, it may have been, originally been a pole god to him. There's a lot of ways to look at that. And the one thing that we do know is that the circle dance becomes like the pivotal dance form of all over Europe, right? And I mean, because I've looked at, like, you know, some of these books on ancient folk songs and dances and games and stuff like that. And every time they mention dance, about 9 times out of 10, it's a circle dance. And so they're recreating that moment. They're recreating like you have to think of like a person who is in that moment, who believes in this wholeheartedly and who hears about the death of their most beloved god. Right, or is told the story of that. This would be a crucial time, like what psychologists call a nuclear episode for them, right? And they would weep, and they would weep Baldur out of hell, and they would try to do everything they could to connect to the gods and try to soothe that pain and be there for it. So it definitely is a recreation of those mythic moments.
That's absolutely fascinating.
Right, and I think you raise a good point there about the dance, because amongst all of the Indo-Europeans, it seems that dance is specifically associated with ritual and metaphysical creation or maintenance, especially amongst the Hindus. For instance, they have Shiva, who produces a dance which sustains the universe.
Right. And movement of pretty much all kinds in a ceremonial form always has some sort of, you know, cosmic relationship to it. Because they saw themselves as moving, and they also saw the sky as moving. So they related the two. You know, the sky moves, the gods are in the sky, I move with the sky. I perform processions, I dance, I move, I walk. I go from one space to another, you know, a mundane space to a sacred space. I mean, these are things that they didn't take for granted. They held it as holy and made it a part of their ritual lives.
And these are people that lived.
Yeah, I would actually like... Oh, I'm sorry, Dave.
Oh, it's okay. I was just going to say that these are people that lived in devotion. These were people that immersed their lives in their faith and immersed their lives in their dedication to the gods and to their ancestors and stuff like that. And
right.
I think this is something that our work, when we put it out there, really resonates with people on a different level than some of the, you know, previous. Not to say that the previous stuff was bad, but you know, this is kind of filling it out in more of an authentic way, because nowadays in secular, modernist, Western society, we're very, very hollow, and most of our time is spent, you know, just doing nothing, doing meaningless things. So when we present right. these ideas that, yes, our ancestors did absolutely live in devotion to the gods, yes, they did absolutely immerse their lives in their, you know, most of their waking moments into their faith and their beliefs, it really resonates, and people are like, wow, I can put more meaning to my life, and it's a really, really special thing.
Yeah,
it's almost hard to even imagine the ancient conception of reality here. That, I mean, these people never knew anything else. They didn't have, you know, really smug atheists walking around telling them that the gods aren't real. This wasn't a thing they ever experienced.
Right.
I mean, most people wouldn't have ever experienced even a foreign religion for most of history. I mean, right. So people's conceptions of, you know, their religious understandings of reality was so rock hard that it would just be like seeing things in front of you. You never question the thing that you see. They never question these beliefs.
Right. And they saw them as connected to everything around them. You know, it was a relationship with nature. It was a relationship with the sky, with the cosmos, and with the divine, with their own spirits, and with their community. I mean, because the faith played out a lot of the aspects of the community. Like we're talking about, like the hell thing, or the thing of the dead. you know, that they had a thing. I mean, that was like a regular concept for them, and it was something that they did on a regular basis to go and, you know, have a festival and mete out justice and, you know, go over complaints for the community and stuff like that. And they saw this as something that was mimicked in the divine realm. It was something that they were going to experience themselves when they go before the gods.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right. And it's also important to note that there often wasn't a very hard divide between what people did in civil society, like courts and laws and community upkeep, and actual religious ritual. It all sort of flowed together, and there wasn't a really hard divide between them.
Right.
For instance, we know when the Goths were starting to be converted to Christianity, they had a big issue with the converts, because their inability to perform pagan rituals was impacting their basic ability to function in a community.
Right. Yeah, and it's like when you're looking at, you know, a lot of times people today make a big deal about animal sacrifice and stuff like that, but it's like you got to look like in those times, in that era, you know, slaughtering animals was an everyday event. It was something you did every day. You know, you had to eat, and so an animal had to die. To even to this day, that happens, but we just have these, you know, slaughterhouses that are far, far away.
We just happen to not see it anymore.
Right? We hide it away, and it's like it's still there. You know, it still happens. And it's all these things, a lot of these things that people are shocked about, you know, that they hear about ancient religions. You know, people talk to us about like human sacrifice, and they think, oh man, back then they performed human sacrifice. Are you guys all for that? And I'm like, well, you know, I live in a country where people still get executed for committing crimes. And that happened. That was a lot of times what the human sacrifice was. And for them, it was a way. You know, and it wasn't always the case. I mean, sometimes people would volunteer for it. Sometimes they would want to do it. Sometimes it was slaves. Sometimes it was, you know, war criminals or whatever. It was people who wanted to give their lives or were forced to give their lives for the betterment of the good because they didn't do so in their life. And so sometimes we believe, and you have to look at this logically, that it was probably for a criminal, like a form of atonement, because everything back then was about atonement. What the word is sohn, you know, and that's where we get the word Sonderblot and Sonderguilter, the atonement boar. And the word sohn was permeated through their laws and through their culture and through the thing. And so if a person gave their life, if they gave their life in sacrifice, it meant there might be a chance at redemption for them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The human sacrifice thing, it's really, really shocking to people. But as Mark mentioned, man, we execute people all the time. We still execute
all the time.
People all the time.
Yeah.
It's just you're adding a religious element to it. And then also, how many people commit suicide? I mean, those people, they don't want to live anymore. They think that their life is meaningless or whatever. Imagine if you could give those people, like, you know, a way out that had meaning. You know what I mean? They're going to kill themselves anyways. Why not let them, you know, do it in something that has more meaning instead of just, you know, popping a bunch of pills or like, you know, whatever kind of horrible. Not that I'm trying to make light of, you know, the suicides through the roof right now. And, you know, as Tristan mentioned about how the Goths just couldn't even like function in everyday society because we took this ritual away from them. I mean, look at how society is today, and we have no ritual, we have no religious element. You know, it's completely and utterly gone. You know, the Goths couldn't function in everyday society back then. We're how many years separated from that now? We're like how many hundreds of years, 1,000 years separated from that lifestyle, and it's just no surprise that we're in such a fallen, messed up state.
Right.
Well, I mean, it's not even so much that we don't have a religious ritual to connect us with civil society, because humans aren't set up to be able to just not have that.
Yeah.
Instead, we replace it with something that's profane. We have a civil religion. We deify celebrities and politicians and stuff like that.
Humanism.
Instead of actual divine forces.
Right. I was going to say, you know, there was a... I think his name was Adolf Reich. He was a psychologist who basically said that, you know, whenever you try to suppress an action, it always comes out perverted. And this is basically the idea of, you know, suppressing the sacred. And every time we say suppress the sacred, it always comes out mundane and perverted, right? Yeah. And so in this sense, we're talking about the perversion of death, where death now is like something that we see relegated to the state. And it's like, okay for them to do this. And, you know, there's really no difference. I mean, you're talking about, you know, a lot of times when prisoners are executed, they go there and they'd have a priest come in and say a prayer over them. And then they get sent off to the gas chamber or whatever, right? Well, what's the difference between 1,000 years ago when a priest would come in and say a prayer over them and throw them in a bog? you know, dead is dead.
Well, you know, that actually makes a good point, Mark, because in modern society, we almost have like a pathological complex around the concept of death. Like most people, you know, that maybe know one person who's ever died, maybe like an elderly family member or something. We don't embrace it. We don't really notice that this happens. We shut it away from us and put it away where people can't see it. We don't talk about it. But for our distant ancestors, death would have been a constant companion to them. I mean, they would have known lots of people who died, animals. They would have killed them constantly. People died in battle and in childbirth and in through sickness. And, you know, like I was saying, it's almost like a pathology now, whereas our ancestors viewed death as a natural part of the life cycle, something that had a sacred meaning. We view it as a sort of perverted something else, the other that we don't want to deal with.
Right. And that's the same thing with everything, you know, like you look in ancient times with things like drug use or sexuality or, you know, all kinds of different aspects of our culture that we look upon as negatively. It's because they've been perverted and taken away from the sacred and turned into the mundane. And so we end up with things like, you know, meth addiction and orgies and, you know, degeneracy. Yeah, and all that stuff. And it's the same exact concept. It's the same mindset. You know, when you suppress it, when you take it away, when you say that it's not sacred anymore, that, you know, that you basically use it to rack up political points or whatever, you know, like that, then you take away that, you know, that sanctity of it. And it makes it where a lot of people, when they get to the end of their life, they live in abject fear of it. They're just thinking, you know, I'm about to die and nothing's going to happen. And I'm just going to fade away. And it creates a terror within the society for all of that, you know, whereas in ancient times, I mean, like you look in the Racilla, right? The account of the slave girl who gets killed there. Like, she's going happily. She sees the other world. She sees the next life. Like, physically sees it. You can feel the belief coming off the page when she says, you know, she gets raised up and she's like, I see my family before me and I see all my ancestors and I see my master waiting for me on the other side. Let me go to him now, please. You know, I mean, this is devotion. This is a person who really believes this is about to happen. Not a person who's terrified and thinks that, you know, I'm going to just fade away into nothing.
Right. You know, I was actually just talking to, you know, my associate Kerwin, that's been on the show a couple of times, about the concept of sati in Indian traditions, where a widow, after her husband would die, would generally burn herself on the own pyre willingly, or the community would sometimes force it, which is actually rather unfortunate. But I was noticing that it actually has a lot of parallels in the Nordic tradition. It comes up quite a few times. Nanna throws her, Baldur's wife, throws herself on his own pyre in grief to be reunited with her love after death in the Helheim. And we also know that the Valkyrie Brynhilda burns herself in grief after Sigurd dies.
Right.
I mean, we can see this sort of thing where, and as you said, Rusila, the slave woman there, this seems to be a trend where a lot of our ancestors didn't quite fear death in the same way people would today. It would almost be very difficult to imagine someone just, you know, burning themselves alive out of grief. I mean, I'm sure it does happen, but it's very, very rare. But it appears to be not something was entirely that rare to our ancestors.
That's incredible. So I want to – we got a lot to talk about still. We're halfway through, but before we move on to the next topic, I want to give a shout-out to our homeboy, Mr. Dino, for his awesome donation. He throws us $1.50. Much love to you, Dino. Brother Dino. That's my dude right there. Great guy. He's working on – I don't know if he wants me to give a shout, but he's working on a virtual library. He's like the
–
he is the folkish librarian, the Hyperborean – librarian or something, but his virtual library that he's working on is absolutely impressive. He spent a lot of time on this thing, so reach out to us if you want to get a copy of it. I don't know how much we're getting into it and stuff like that, but reach out to me if you want a copy of Dino's virtual library, and we'll get that into the works. It's a really, really great project that he's working on. Really, really brilliant guy. So let's move on to the next topic here. We wanted to talk about the Cetean calendar, Mr. Mark.
Right. So that's the thing that we're working on right now, you know, and that's one thing I wanted to tell all the listeners out there. You know, we've got books that we've put out on a lot of this stuff, And it's a little bit frustrating for me because I've put out these books, I wrote books, and you know, you publish things and you're like, oh, you know, you think you got the formula down, and then you make a whole bunch of discoveries.
Surprise.
You're like, oh man, I got to rewrite all this stuff, you know, and that's where we're at. I mean, the Cinda book is going to be completely redrafted. We're redoing the Griffin's book. We're redoing a bunch of stuff. You know, there's a bunch of things that's going to happen. The ritual stuff is just coming at us. There's so much coming at us over this, and there's so many ideas that are gelling and coming out of it that we're really having to, you know, rebuild this and reestablish a lot of the traditions. But it's okay because, you know, that's something that's meaningful, and we want to make sure that when we do it, you know, when we finally, like when I die or when we all pass the torch at some point, that we got it right. You know, we don't want to get stuck in our ways and be like, well, we did this and this is the way it is. And, you know, sorry, you know, because it's about passing the torch to the next generation. It's about planting that seed and letting the oak grow, you know. And so this is what's happening with the calendar, because we stopped and I said, you know, what, let's look at a calendar and let's look at having the bloats that are in the sources rather than obsessing over the dates. You know, because the dates are something that just everybody wants a date. They want a specific time that something happens, right?
I've been very frustrated with that myself, because that's the first thing anyone asks you is, I want to know exactly what to do in the ritual, and I want to know exactly when to do it now. And right. Unfortunately, we just don't have that specific detail. I mean, it's not available to us. We have there are details we have, but they're much more vague. Like, we're going to do this near the equinox, or, you know, in the middle of winter, right?
Right. And there's a whole debate between like a solar calendar and a lunar calendar and all that stuff, right? And I don't ever knock anybody for doing either one. You know, if you want to follow the solstices and equinoxes, which I do, you know, or you want to follow it where you've, you know, use the first full moon after them, that's fine too, you know. But the fact is that most of the sources, you know, remark this, and we do know that the Prosetta and Adam of Bremen mention our ancestors celebrating the equinoxes and solstices, and this was a part of their culture, and this is when they, you know, celebrated the movement of the sun across the sky. And we do have a lot of references to a lot of these traditions and a lot of these bloats. Now, the first thing we want to look at when we're discussing this is that a bloat is not a festival. Okay, so when you're looking at festivals are like Ostara and Yule and Midsummer and Winter Nights and stuff like that. Those are festivals. The word is Vesla or Veslu, right? And we actually found this in the sagas mentioned several times when they're talking about this. Like, I think they mentioned the Alpha Bloat is said to be practiced in the Veslu of Winter Nights. And, you know, there's actually
very, very, very private, the opposite of a festival, really.
Right, right. And then, like, there's a word like Yule Veslu, which means the Yule festival. And so it's not an actual bloat, right? The bloat is something different. And so what we wanted to do was, because, you know, I use a solar calendar and I basically, you know, build upon the solstices and equinoxes and the points in between, you know, and actually try to find the points in between, not the specific date like May 1st or whatever, but actually use it as a moving, you know, astronomical calendar, which is what our ancestors were trying to do. They were looking to the sky, they were studying the stars, studying the moon, studying the suns, studying those movements, and they built, like, you know, huge structures around it, and they built, you know, like you have the Nebra sun disk, and you have all these different things that we know that they were doing. You know, they had the calendar sticks, and I mean, they were very big into observing the stars and observing the sky, and we want to do that too. We want to have people use our modern technology and be able to, you know, basically pinpoint exactly when these events happen, and, you know, the points in between as well. And then use a calendar having the eight sacred bloats that we perform for specific blessings. Because every time we have mentions of bloats, a lot of times they're mentioned, not every time, but a blessing is mentioned. Like, you're focusing towards a specific blessing. So I believe that those blessings were what you were trying to go for. Like, when we look in Ynglinga Saga, I think it's in chapter 8, I think, that they talked about, you know, Odin tells us to have a festival at the beginning of the year, at midwinter, and at the you know, the beginning of summer for the Sigur bloat, right? And so he's basically telling us that this is what we should do, and we should have these bloats to celebrate these points in time. And we look at, you know, when he's saying to do this, he's saying, you know, we're going to have this for good crops, for a good year, and for victory, right? And so those are three specific blessings that we're trying to go for. And I think that that is the main point of doing this, you know, is you're trying to reach to the gods. You're trying to mimic that point of death, you know, to the point where you're actually physically going to, you know, touch the gods. And then you're going to seek these eight different blessings throughout the year. So in looking at that, we started, you know, looking over the sources, looking over the material, trying to figure out what we can do. Because the dates go all over the place. Like if you look at Disa Bloat's mentioned to happen in midwinter, happen at winter nights, happen in the spring. You know, the Alpha Bloat is mentioned in several different times. So we know that either this is just the chroniclers getting it wrong, or this is just tribal cultural differences, which is perfectly
right. Right. I actually have a theory about that myself. I think the as I've mentioned in the calendar chat itself, that the Icelandic people only really recognize two different seasons as summer and winter,
right?
Because of the climatic conditions in Iceland itself. I mean, they don't really have any other seasons, but the continental Germanic people and most of Scandinavia proper recognized three different seasons, right. that we know of, at least. I mean, and I think a lot of the confusion between the different dates are Icelanders in a later period looking back at older traditions that are referencing three different seasons and not understanding them and trying to fit them into their two season paradigm.
Right. And that's why I say, like, you know, when you're looking at these things and you're trying to reconstruct a belief system around it or culture around it and all that stuff, the most important thing that you can do is look at the mechanics of it all. Like, how does it work rather than what is it, you know? Because what is it is like that's materialist anachronism. That's trying to recreate the 10th century. But what you want to do is you want to understand, like, why were they doing this? What was the importance of it? And then once you do that, you can start to, you know, to construct things for you in the here and now with modern technology and being able to look up, you know, atomic clocks and, you know, all of the pinpoints of specific events that as they happen in the moment. That's what we have today. And so our ancestors would have done that as well. I mean, if you were to take the internet to them back then, they would have thought you were a god, you know? And so you have these things at your fingertips and you can use them, right? So what we were looking at in trying to establish these eight holidays, right, is just basically looking over the bloats. Like you have Thor bloat, which is mentioned in the sagas, and you have there's the Disa bloat, and we talked about Fals bloat being a reconstruction from Fulstag or Pulatag. And then we have the Sigur bloat, the Alpha bloat, the Haust bloat, the Vetra bloat, and the Sonar bloat, right? Let me know if I forgot any. But so all of these have like a different blessing for them. Every single one of them has a different blessing throughout the year, so that once you've completed the calendar year, you have received all eight blessings. And then you renew the cycle, right? And so that's what you're going for. You're, you know, Odin tells us in Havamal not to offer too much, right? A gift always looks for a gift. And this is probably why, because, you know, why they had these blessings that they focused on specifically during one specific bloat rather than asking for whatever you want, right? It's because you can only offer and ask for one thing at a time. And so you're giving all these offerings and all these things to the gods, and you have to focus it, you know, at the Disa bloat for health, you know, for the Thor bloat for a good year or a good crop, I'm sorry, the Vetra bloat for a good year. This a different blessing connected to them, and that's what you're trying to do is to have a blessed year, basically. But the you guys there? You know, all the things.
Yeah, Mr. Mark, your internet's getting a little bit, you're starting to roll right, out. On.
Yeah, you had a bit of a hiccup there, but okay. It seems to be maybe better now.
All right, sorry about that.
Okay, so, yeah, that's really, you know, fascinating stuff. And it's really, really wonderful seeing all of these things kind of blossom and turn. You know, you mentioned about earlier in the episode about how when we come across all this new information and it fleshes out, and then you got to go back and rewrite books and stuff like, and yeah, doing all that kind of work is kind of a, you know, pain in the butt. But that's a really wonderful problem to have, honestly.
Because
it really means that we're growing and we're developing newer understandings, and what that means That is a testament to meaning that there is greater depth to this faith than what we've been told for like the past, you know, however many years that we've been doing, and that it can further become more evolved and deeper and more nuanced. It's a really wonderful thing seeing this all blossom. But we got 15 minutes left, so we had one more topic. Because last time we did a show, Mr. Mark, we ran out of time, like through like half of our content. So I want to give you a chance to hit everything the whole time. So you wanted to mention about the hour,
or the Icelandic pronunciation is Ur, but we'll just go with our for our English speaking audience.
A-U-R-R,
right? Now, the one thing that we're looking at, you know, when we started reconstructing the altar and sort of looking at the underworld symbolism, right, is that, and I think this is something that pretty much most authors, people in heathenry, people even in some academics probably looked at it, is that the idea of the bloat bowl or the laut bowl, right, is basically the underworld wells, right? This is the well of weird. This is the well, Mimir's well. This is Vergilmer, right? And so what we did was we were like, well, if we're going to be rebuilding the underworld here, why not just have three bowls, right? And each one represents a different well, and each one has a different substance. Like Vergilmer is called the mother of water, so it would have water in it. And Mimirsbrunn is the mead well that Odin drinks from. And Urd's well has a substance that's connected to it called Vita Aur, or Vita Ur, right? Excuse me. So this Ur, or Aur, we think it's probably a lot more than what we're being translated, you know, what we're being told in translations and how we're looking at it in a materialist level, because it's not just something that's just a substance. Like the actual literal translation of it is like a clay or a mud or a loam or something like that, right? But the thing about it is that this word is, it forms the prefix of like many different names in the sources, okay? So, and every one of these names, they have some connection to like a storyline, and this primordial storyline that you know, basically plays out the creation story. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that you have Audunla, the sacred cow, right, who licks the ice, the rimr, right, or the rhyme. And from this ice, this licking of the ice, a being is formed. This is Buri, and he's the father of Bur. Now, Audumla, this is something that we just think is possible, but it may be that the word Aurochs or Uroks may have had a connection to this. And there are, you know, some older dictionaries and stuff like that that talk about the possibility of it representing like a slag or a rain or something wet. And that's a connection to this word Ur that these guys were looking at. Some etymologists disagree, but either way. Now, the thing is about it is that she licks this rhyme, right? And from that, Ymir drinks her milk from her udders, right? When he does this, he literally sweats beings out. Now, here you have two different instances. One is a licking of the ice and a being comes from it. And the second one is a drinking of this milk substance that's already saturated with this ice, with this rhyme. The quick drops is what it's called in the sources, kvikudropper, right? And it's basically the substance of creation. Everything gets created from it. The heat, you know, melts it, and things are created from it. So we believe that it's more than just ice and rime and mud and all that stuff. We think it's like a representation of fertility itself, because Ymir drinks this milk, and he sweats beings out of his body, and he becomes Urgelmer, right? And it's basically the roar of Ur or Ar, right? And so this connects him to that substance. Now what happens is the gods, you know, Odin and his brothers kill Ymir, and they make the land from his flesh, and his flesh becomes the soil. Now what this happens in the underworld, this is called Orvengaland, which means the fields, the land of the fields of Ur, right? And the mud that has come from this gets this name Vita Ur. Which the Norns, they you know, basically use this, and they mix it with their sacred mead in their well, and they spread it upon the tree. Now the substance gets called Vita Ur, and then the tree becomes Ur Glasser, which means the resplendent in Ur, right? Now Honur is also a god of he's one of Odin's brothers, and he is, you know, basically the caretaker of the underworld. He's one of the first banner and a fertility god, and he's connected to birth and childbirth and all kinds of fertile concepts. And he becomes Ur-Kanung, which means the king of the order, mm-hmm. right? And so these words, they all have an interrelationship to themselves. And it's basically representing a sacred substance that we can mimic in our ceremonies with milk and mixing milk with mead, because it goes back to Althumla's milk, to the Vita order, to this sacred substance of fertility. And I'm sure Tristan can attest to the usage of milk in the Hindu religion and the sources that come from that.
Oh, absolutely. It's all over the place, especially in the specific sects dealing with Shiva are very prominent in using milk. They like to pour it over the Shivling, which is a sort of an iconic image of Shiva's power. And as we would say, Shiva is directly cognate to Odin himself. So in this sense, we have the representation of the chief god is very connected with this milk sort of thing. And also the cattle in general are very important to the Indo-European people. They pop up all over the place, and they are literally our word for money is what was cattle. It's even in the runes themselves.
Yep, right. Yep, so, first rune.
B. Yeah. Right. And the thing is about this is that when you're looking at this substance and you're looking at these three wells, right? The water or the Vita Aura, which is what this becomes for us in the ceremony. You know, we're basically, when we are standing at the roots of the tree and we pour a libation of this substance, we are mimicking exactly what we are told in the lore that's what the Norns do when they are pouring it upon the roots of Yggdrasil, right? So it all comes full circle. Everything comes full circle. So, when we're looking at this whole idea and this whole concept of recreating this altar based on the underworld, and we look at the whole layout of the grid and the sacred space, the gods themselves as pole gods or whatever, right? Then we're starting to see that all of these things start to come to life. The symbolism within the lore comes to life. Another thing that was on the list, Dave, that you forgot was the gates, right?
Oh yeah.
And I just want to throw that in there real quick because it's really important, because it kind of rounds out everything that we're saying. I just recently posted on Facebook about this, there's a passage in Havamal which mentions the one of the rune songs says, a 15th, I know what the dwarf Fjordur sang before Delling's door, power to the Aesir, wisdom to the Alfar, or glory to the Alfar and wisdom to Roftatir. It's basically Delling's door could just be, Delling is the dwarf or elf of the dawn, and it could just mean a door in the east, right? In the Rasila, we see a slave girl who gets lifted up three times, and it's said that they create a door frame for her to peer through. There are scholars who have found, ideas and concepts of these sort of gateways that were put in front of grave mounds, and they called them portals. And it's something kind of like the Shinto, with their torii. It's a way of looking into the underworld. And we know that in the lore, we have the Helgrindr, which are the hell gates, right? Which is basically like the receiving portal. And so this is something that, we're seeing that is playing out a lot of historic information, and it really just builds upon what we've been saying all along about, the ritual space is the underworld.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. It really ties everything together and gives everybody like a much greater understanding of what exactly we're doing with these rituals, and it gives it more meaning, and it layers meaning upon meaning, and it's really, really excellent stuff. But I actually wanted to ask you about something real quick. I've some experimental stuff that I do with the song and stuff like that, yeah, with the Schumann resonance, and one of my Schumann resonance tracks, the only one that I put on my YouTube, I do an Alu chant. And
right.
Alu is something that we find all over the place. It's carved right. into the ceremonial things, into amulets, into all kinds of stuff, and it just ties into kind of what we were talking about here. I brought this up to our good buddy Mr. Tom over at Survive the Jive in his Discord. And he said, I just asked him about it, what he thought of it. And he shared a link that it meant it had something to do with brewing mead or brewing ale, brewing, creating. So,
right.
And right away that clicked for me that it had to do with creation. And then let's hear, what is your take on on Alu?
Well, I completely agree with what Tom is saying. And I actually think that it just goes back to the whole idea of mead itself. Brewing and mead are intertwined. And if you're talking about mead, you're talking about the underworld wells, right? Because we always look for the origins. Our ancestors always looked, you know, traced things back, so everything had an origin, and it always started with the you know, the creation story and the underworld wells. Mm-hmm. So the when you're looking at the ALU formula, ALU, Os, Lugr, and Urd, or Ur, right? Or in the old Gothic form, it'd be Ensus, Lagu, and Urus, right? The you'd have to look at the definitions of the names themselves. Osk is Odin, or the or a god, the gods, right? Odin himself is the one who drank from Mimir's well, and it's his principal, you know, event that happens for him that makes him the king of the gods, right? It's the most important event that happens for him. So we're looking directly at wisdom, at, you know, the idea of Mimir's well and connecting to it. And the rune poems lead us in that direction as well. And then you have Lagu or Lugr, which is, you know, water, a lake. It's where the word loch comes from, or lake. And it's, you know, the idea of Virglimer. Virglimer is said to be the mother of all waters. And it's said that all these rivers, you know, stretch throughout the underworld and go up into Midgard and Asgard, and they always come back to its primary source. So Virglimer represents water. Then Ur is the rune of the sacred cow of the ancient, you know, Aldhumla, which we just spoke of, the Ur, you know, the Vita Ur is, you know, connected to that. And then there's the whole idea of strength and power. And one of the names of Urd's well is Urdhermagen, which means Urd's strength. So you're really looking at a formula that is directly connected in multiple ways, both to Mead and to the sacred wells. So that's probably why, because like I said, when we trace, like everything I do, when we're looking in the Norna Society work and we're trying to understand things, we're always trying to look back at the origins of them. Where did these things come from? How did they build? What did they believe? And what is it? How does it connect? And so many times when you're just looking at the symbolism of things, it just goes right back to the underworld wells and the creation story.
That's incredible.
You know, Mark, I would actually like to discuss this Ord with you a bit here, because I just had a sort of eureka moment as you were talking about this, actually. See, there's a Hindu story called the Churning of the Ocean of Milk,
right?
In which all of the gods go around and the Amrito, which is their elixir of immortality, it's equivalent to Ethun's apples, has fallen into the primordial ocean, which is this ocean of milk.
Right.
And all of the gods have to enlist the help of their enemies, the demons, the Asura, in order to help them churn this ocean. And they use Mount Meru, which is the world axis. It's cognate in our tradition to Yggdrasil, as a sort of a big spoon, like a churning stick, in order to churn the ocean and bring up this elixir of immortality so they can benefit from it. Now, as you would say that this is a sort of milk here, if we consider for a moment that Othumbla licks the poison from, as we know, the frozen ice she's licking is actually the frozen venom of Niflheim as it comes down the river and freezes up into a sort of venom, and she licks it up, and we could say she almost inside of herself produces a sort of alchemy in order to transform it into a creative force, to separate the chaotic force from a creative force. That's why Ymir drinks from her milk, and that's when he can produce creation amongst himself.
Right, and that is absolutely the truth. I totally agree with you there. And the thing about this is that we see this force, it gets played out throughout the stories, both in the divine realm and the chaotic realm, right? Like when Gullveig is killed and Loki eats her heart to create the demons, Jormungandr, Fenrir, and Laken, right? When this happens, the heart is called Ursvul, right? And Ursvul means primordial cold. It's, you know, the same as the word Ur, where the word Aur comes from, right? And so it's like this ancient cold, and it's also connected to the idea of Ur. And it's basically going back to this idea of fertility. Her heart can't die, and she's going to be reborn because her heart is made up of this Rimer element, or rhyme element, which is an element of pure creation and fertility. And, you know, some chaotic beings will use it, like Ymir does and Gullveig does, or the gods use it to create things and do good with it, right? And so the Svor part is actually used in connection to Vergelmer, which is the well in Niflhel or Niflheim, and it's called Svalkaldr Ser, and which means the cool, cold sea. Now, another interesting connection to that, we can go even further, is that Seirimnir, the boar that gets reborn in Valhall, you know, he possibly has that same connection as well, because it's said that he is, you know, created, or basically he's cooked in the pot Eldrimnir by the cook Andrimnir, right? Now, Eldrimnir means fire rhyme, Seirimnir means sea rhyme, and Andrimnir means spirit rhyme. It's that goes right back to the underworld wells.
Right, and actually, one of the main myths in the Churning of the Myth story here is that all the gods and the devas are over there churning the milk in order to produce the elixir of immortality. Only Shiva notices that the Naga, which is a sort of serpent, has vomited forth venom into the sea, and it's going to corrupt the elixir. And he notices that he's the only one who notices this, and ingests the poison himself in order to, you know, save basically all the gods, all of creation. And it's such a strong poison that it stays with him forever. It's why he continually has a blue throat from it being lodged inside of him. And I think that pairs very well to what you were saying about the poisonous venom in the heart of Gullveig. As we can see, some of the details are switched around here, or they're in different places, but all of the main points in the story appear to be more or less the same. We keep hitting upon all of them here, the different the milk and the mead and the alcohol and the venom and all these things, the world axis and creation. And right. I think that goes to show that we're definitely on to something here, even if we don't have it exactly right, that this is definitely a very, very ancient story that our ancestors believed in, and we're very, very close to getting here. We have all the points we have. We just need to arrange them into exactly how this happened.
Right. And I think, though, you know, and concluding here, when we're talking about all this stuff with the ritual and lore and all that stuff, is that, you know, as we continue to build this and we continue to establish it, we're building something that is sacred and is going to continue to have layer upon layer upon layer of it. You know, we started out, you know, building like the sacred meter forms of Jodahadr and Galdralag, right, which we're told in Ynglinga Saga were given to us as gifts by the gods, who are called the Lodasmiths and the Galdrasmiths. And when, you know, Odin learns the runes that's mentioned in Havamal, they're called Fimbuljodr, which is still connected to that Jodahadr, right? And so it all is building upon symbols and building upon songs and ritual forms that we have in our sources. We thought for so long that we didn't have this stuff, but it's there. You just have to look at it with fresh eyes, and you have to look at it from the eyes of a person who truly believes in these gods and truly believes in this faith and sees it as a religion rather than some political platform or New Age concept or whatever.
Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah, I would agree 100% with that.
All right. Whew. Wow, that was an information crunch right there. Beautiful stuff. Excellent stuff. But Mr. Mark, we hit all your points tonight. We hit all your points.
Yay! So
that's an excellent, excellent stuff. I hope everybody really enjoyed the episode. I know I did. It's always wonderful having Mr. Mark on here because he's such a brilliant guy, and you know him and Tristan together just like in the same podcast just melts faces. It's out of control. It's out of control.
It's great.
It's great stuff. It's really a blessing being able to rub shoulders with so many awesome, smart people in around the society. It's really, really great. If you start hanging around like some of our chats or so, in like 2 months, you'll be like, yeah, your IQ will go up by 20 points. I'm not even kidding. It's incredible.
and that's something important to note, too. Within the Norona Society, we have so much more going on than we actually publicly put forward because, you know, we're still working on it and refining concepts and everything. But everyone who's in on the process, I mean, we go through this stuff for months and months, and there's just so much information more that, you know, we can't share. It would take too long to share with everyone.
Yeah.
Right. There's been times where I've spent 3 or 4 weeks studying a single word.
Right.
That's incredible. And Mr. Mark, how long has Neurona Society been at it now?
It's been about over a decade now.
That's incredible. That's really incredible. It goes to show how long-standing true things and authentic things are. How many like fly-by-night operations like just appear and then they crash and burn and they rise and fall and all this all over the place. Nerna society is like the pyramids, man. It just stays forever. It's just long standing.
Hopefully.
yeah, absolutely. And it's going to be really cool passing this stuff down to our children and over the generations, starting to help enlighten our folk and bring our folk back home where we belong, and putting devotion to our gods, our true ancestral spiritual path, back into the cultural standard that it once was. You know, the gods belong back on their thrones, man. Our ancestors deserve their worship. So we're coming home, man. It's all coming together. It's really, we put in a lot of work over there in Nerdist Society, man. We do it because we love it. We do it because it's we're obligated. We're on a mission here. So I'm gonna give one more plug to Mr. Mark's book. I can't recommend this thing enough, guys. Otis book, absolutely tremendous, absolutely tremendous. I saw somebody mention about Mother Earth in the comments. I don't have it on hand. I usually do, just in case I can give him a plug. And our boy Mr. William Reeves over at Neurona Society has what it's called Odin's Wife. It's called Odin's Wife by William
Excellent
Reeves.
Book.
Excellent, excellent book. Great stuff. And one more book plug before we shut it down here. Make sure you get the Odinist Edda or the Also True Edda. All of this stuff's available on Amazon. All this stuff must be on your shelf. It's not an option. If you are Also True or just interested in learning about your ancestral faith, what your ancestors did, these are must-haves on your bookshelf. Absolutely, 100%. So we are going to shut it down for this evening. Do you guys have any closing remarks? Mr. Mark?
No, just everybody come, you know, visit our website, pay attention to our YouTube channel. We're on Facebook, you know, we're all over the place. So just stay tuned. You know, we're always posting updates and trying to give out, like, whenever we have like some of the best conclusions that we know we've kind of locked down, we put that stuff out there. And just, you know, you can, it's usually on our Norna Society Facebook page when I write that stuff up, but I try to get videos on YouTube and things like that out there too every now and then, and we're just always trying to grow and understand more.
Yeah, Neurona Society YouTube channel is great. Go over, subscribe to that. Recently, Mr. Mark has been working on the mythological schools of thought. Those are absolutely great. Absolutely great. Great stuff. What do you got next? You got
the nature school and the archetypal school, and then we'll go over our school, the epic school.
The epic school. That's a question I get a lot about, the epic method and Victor Rydberg and stuff. We got to do an episode on that eventually. But
yeah, absolutely.
Mr. Tristan, do you have any closing for tonight?
Yeah, I do. I see in the chat here people are asking, how do we contact the Bog in order to come on the show? And it's very simple. You would want to contact either me or Mr. Dave here. You can contact us a number of different ways through Facebook or Telegram or in various different public groups. Anyone in contact with the Neurona Society could also contact us, as we're all members there. Or, you know, ask around your friends. I'm sure someone is in a public group or has some one of our contact details. You would want to talk to us about coming on the show. We would discuss everything and see what we want to do. But if you have anything to offer, absolutely, fire away. We'll be happy to have you.
Yeah, we should set up an email or something so people could send us stuff. I got a good question. Easiest way to get a hold of me is on Telegram. On Telegram, just search Dave Martell. You'll find me. So that's going to be it for this evening, guys. Thank you so much to everybody. Thank you to my awesome, awesome guest, Mr. Mark Pereer, my good buddy, colleague. Thank you again to my awesome co-host, Mr. Tristan, for coming on, man. What a tremendous episode. Tremendous, tremendous episode. So we are going to close it down, and I'm also going to give a shout-out, like always, to my homegirl, Miss Hannah, traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Stop giving your money to the multinational globalist vampires that hate your guts and want to destroy you. They absolutely do. Look at all the propaganda they put out in their commercials. They hate you, man. They absolutely hate you. They sell you poison, literal poison, plastics, synthetics, all this garbage. It trashes your hair, trashes your body, trashes your skin. Man, you owe it to yourself to get good stuff and opt out of the system that destroys you, man. Give money to somebody that loves you and makes wonderful products that will help you and that make you look beautiful and shining just like your ancestors did. So go to traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com, promo code Dave to get 10% off. I use it. My wife uses it. My mom uses it. Dr. G uses it. It's doctor approved. Great stuff. traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com, promo code Dave, 10% off. I'll see you guys next week here on The Bog, which is every single Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern. I forget what we got next week. I think we got, I can't remember. Doesn't matter. It'll be awesome. So tune in next week. Like, subscribe, share, click the alert button so you can alert every time we go live.
Every Single Thursday. I'll see you guys next week, man. Take care. Hail.